Welcome to Oncology Today, Rounds with the Investigator, a discussion of the role of endocrine-based therapy for hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this special edition, I met with Dr. Sarah Hurvitz from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle as a follow-up to our program at the 2024 San Antonio Breast Cancer Annual Meeting. To begin, I asked Dr. Hurvitz for her thoughts on the PATINA study on the role of CDK4/6 inhibition in the management of HER2-positive breast cancer.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it was presented on Thursday morning, and we, you know, the data came in for the group presenting it the weekend before, and it came to me, I think, the day before in its final format. So it was definitely a rushed, late breaker. But the data is really interesting, and it represents, I would say, 15 years of work preclinically and clinically to interrogate this question of whether or not CDK4/6 inhibitors are useful in HER2-positive breast cancer. And I think all the data lines up solidly from Sham Goel and Rich Finn and Neil O'Brien's work preclinically showing that it should work in hormone receptor-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer. And then a number of other clinicians and investigators have done studies that have indicated, including, you know, Sarah Tulaney with Monarcher, the DETECT 5 study presented, I think, at ESMO, and then PATINA showing that, you know, blocking hormone receptors with HER2 and CDK4/6 inhibitors yields a better outcome than really even chemotherapy-based therapy. So, you know, this study was super unique in the way it was done. Patients all received their induction chemotherapy with HER2-targeted therapy for 6 to 8 cycles. And then if they had anything except for progression of disease, so as long as they had stable disease or better, they were then enrolled in the study and randomized to receive maintenance HP with endocrine therapy and either with palbociclib or not. And the patients who received just the hormone-targeted therapy and endocrine therapy, their progression-free survival was like 29 months, which was historic, right? If you think of Cleopatra, the progression-free survival was like 18 and a half months with HP maintenance after induction chemo. So that was really impressive, but it was only hormone receptor positive, HER2-positive breast cancer, which has better outcomes. And patients were randomized after completion of the 6 to 8 cycles of therapy. So you're eliminating all those patients who have super resistant disease and are progressing in that first 6 to 8 months. And you're just taking those patients who likely had the luminal type of HER2-positive breast cancer. But adding palbociclib to HP and endocrine therapy brought that PFS up to 44 months. So I feel these data are practice changing. I don't know that we'll ever get an FDA approval. It'll be interesting to see if the NCCN guidelines add this. And I think as we go forward, we need to be looking at HER2-positive breast cancer based on subtypes within that class. We should be accounting for the hormone receptor subtype and trying to integrate hormonally targeted therapies. We should be looking at things like PI3 kinase pathway and inhibitors, et cetera. So I think it's kind of a new era for us that we're entering.
Yeah, it's funny because you were saying, you know, that you were in the program on Wednesday night. Patina was presented Thursday morning, and you did the discussion. And then we did another CME program Thursday night, and we were kind of joking about the fact that I had asked you a little bit about it the night before, but we hadn't seen the data, so you really didn't say too much. And people were saying they thought maybe you were up half the night getting your discussion ready to try to figure out what to say about it. It was something I think I didn't expect to see, that, you know, a trial like that presented, and I guess you had to scramble around to figure out what it meant.
Yeah, it was almost an all-nighter, Neil, and I got a terrible cold like 2 days later. I had the worst cold I've had in years because my body isn't built for the all-nighters anymore, but it was a lot of fun. It was worth it.
So just for practical purposes, is this something that you already have incorporated into your practice prior to seeing these data, or are you doing it now, or what are you thinking?
So prior to these data, I would use CDK4/6 inhibitors in very late line HER2-positive, hormone receptor-positive breast cancer in patients who'd exhausted everything. Because sometimes these patients have been alive 10 or more years and have indolent behaving disease and have a good performance status. And so I've used it in that case, especially when Monarcher came out showing the benefits with abemaciclib. Now, if I have a patient, I have several patients who are just beginning their induction chemo with HP and they have hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive breast cancer. And yes, I will be discussing these data with them as we enter the maintenance phase. I mean, the toxicity, you're going to have to monitor patients for neutropenia. Some patients do really well for years with HP alone. So I think it's not a slam dunk that we need to be adding palbo at this point, but it is something to discuss.
I guess the other thing is that maybe we're going to see a change in first-line therapy in the near future in terms of T-DXd alone or with pertuzumab. I don't know if you have any thoughts about when we might see the data. I think it's Destiny-09. I don't remember the number, but any predictions about what we're going to see, whether or not pertuzumab is still going to be involved here that you've done so much work with over the years, and how, you know, CDK might fit in if that becomes our first-line therapy?
Yeah, it's a terrific question. I wasn't part of the study, but I do listen to the rumor mill, and the rumor mill says that probably in the next year we will hear something. So I think it doesn't take somebody who's able to read the tea leaves really well to predict that T-DXd will probably beat THP, just comparing Cleopatra and Destiny Breast 03, it's pretty clear that T-DXd is probably going to have a better progression-free survival, maybe a better overall survival. But you're right, the question that'll be begged is, what do we do in the maintenance setting? Like, there is no maintenance with T-DXd. These patients are going to be on chemo until progression, which could be many years. Is that really right for them? And I'm not convinced that it is. And they didn't build into that study doing induction T-DXd followed by maintenance HP. And I think that's the next question to be addressed. I don't think that adding pertuzumab to T-DXd is going to win. I don't think that that's going to add much. I mean, we have the Marianne negative study didn't show that pertuzumab added to T-DM1 was really beneficial. So, but I do think T-DXd will probably be the winner, and very quickly we're going to have to sort out whether patients can safely drop the T-DXd and do something easier.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I kind of agree with you in terms of pertuzumab. Any issues? I mean, I think you can see interstitial lung disease with CDK. I know it's very uncommon. Yeah. Any potential concerns about that?
Yeah, I would TDXD? Be a little. Yeah, I'd be a little reluctant to add CDK4/6 inhibitors to T-DXd. I would more want to see switching to an HP type maintenance with endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitor, because yeah, we don't want to push that given the fatal cases we've seen with T-DXd.
All right, so let's get into some of the topics that we talked about. Again, beginning with your talk, really on this whole program was focused on endocrine treatment in general. We didn't even get into HER2 positive, but of course, but you reviewed the data looking at particularly adjuvant CDK. And before I ask you about that and kind of what your thoughts are about that, and maybe elaborate a little bit more about what you presented and thought about there, maybe you can tell us a little bit about this 65-year-old lady that you took care of.
Yeah, she had a routine screening mammo that found a right breast abnormality. She underwent a core biopsy and it was completely negative. And the radiologist looked at the pathology and where the biopsy happened and said, this is discordant. This looks suspicious. So she went forward. It's kind of unusual now. You don't usually do excisional biopsies, but she had to have an excisional biopsy, and it did reveal two foci of invasive ductal carcinoma that were pretty similar. One was 25 millimeters, one was 20 millimeters, grade two, but extensive lymphovascular invasion. The ER and PR were strongly, or the ER was strongly positive, the PR was negative, and the HER2 was negative. And so she underwent a completion mastectomy because the margins were widely positive, given it was an excisional biopsy. There was no residual disease in the breast, and there were three lymph nodes that were negative. She did have germline genetic testing that was negative. And then given this extensive lymphovascular invasion and the fact that she was very healthy with few comorbidities and would accept chemotherapy if it was recommended, we pursued doing 21 gene recurrence score testing, and her recurrence score came back as 28. So she was treated with docetaxel cyclophosphamide for four cycles, and now we're going to be discussing the use of adjuvant endocrine therapy and the role of a CDK4/6 inhibitor in somebody who has negative lymph nodes.
So before we get into the data that relates to this kind of a decision, I noticed that you tested her. She's 65. I don't see anything about a family history. Out of curiosity, as a side note, we had the ASCO SSO guidelines come out. They said everybody 65 and younger should be tested. Do you do that? And do you test everybody? Why did you test her?
I feel that we are now in an era where we have the availability of targeted therapy for patients who have germline mutations. And I also feel that the information is so useful to blood relatives for cascade testing and primary prevention that everyone should be tested. It's no longer a situation where the test is so expensive because only one company does it. We can do this in an affordable manner. It's usually covered by insurance. So yes, I follow the ASCO guidelines. We do work with genetic counselors in our practice, and we have, we're now focusing on how to improve point of care testing rather than having everybody go to a genetic counselor, and utilizing, all of the modern, virtual visits that we can do, et cetera, to make counseling available to our patients who have positive results or need to meet with somebody. But it just seems like it's low-hanging fruit and we should be doing it.
We did a survey of what people are doing, and it's like all over the place.
It
like,
is.
not too many people are doing what you do, but there's an incredible difference in terms of age, et cetera, et cetera. I think what you said makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about the data that we've got out there right now, particularly two major clinical trials looking at the issue of CDK. Can you kind of capsulize what we know about that and how that's getting translated to your decision-making in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first study that was done in the adjuvant setting that was positive was the MONARCH-E clinical trial looking at 2 years of adjuvant abemaciclib with endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy alone. And to get on this study, patients had to have lymph node positive disease. They either had to have four or more positive lymph nodes, or if they had 1 to 3 positive nodes, they had to have grade 3 disease or a larger tumor of at least 5 centimeters. Now, there was a smaller cohort in there that allowed patients on if they had a high Ki-67, if they didn't meet the grade and tumor size criteria, but that was a smaller cohort. And we now have almost 5 years of follow-up, 54-month follow-up that was published last year in JCO, showing a significant benefit with a hazard ratio of 0.68. And the 5-year invasive disease-free survival outcome is over 7.5% absolute benefit. The subgroup seemed to indicate, benefit across a wide variety of subgroups. distant relapse-free survival at 5 years seems to be improved by close to 7%, and the hazard ratio looks pretty similar. And although survival is not statistically significant, it is trending in the right direction. The main side effects to worry about with abemaciclib, of course, are diarrhea, which is something patients must be informed about and monitored closely for, venous thromboembolic events, interstitial lung disease, and then, of course, neutropenia in about a quarter of patients. So it's approved and used in the United States. It's in our it's a level one recommendation for patients who have high risk node positive disease. The NATALEE study looked at use of ribociclib, and this included high-risk patients with node-positive disease, but uniquely, it also allowed patients with node-negative disease as long as it was stage 2A. For node-negative disease, it had to be grade 2 and have evidence of high risk based on Ki-67 of at least 20% or a recurrent score of at least 26 or other high-risk genomic profiling or grade 3. And this was ribociclib. And the difference is it's 3 years of ribociclib and it's 3 weeks on, 1 week off with an aromatase inhibitor or the aromatase inhibitor alone. And, you know, the majority of patients actually had node-positive disease. About 20% of the patients enrolled had stage 2A disease. So some people will say, use ribo if you have low-risk disease, abema if you have high-risk disease. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that only about a quarter of the patients had node-negative disease. The rest of them had node-positive disease. And the study ended a little bit after the results came out for Monarch E, so we don't have as long a follow-up with it, but we are seeing sort of similar trends that the curves continue to separate out over time. And at ESMO in 24, the 44-month follow-up data was shown, and there was a almost a 5% invasive disease-free survival benefit at 4 years. The hazard ratio was 0.71 and highly significant. And the benefit seemed to be regardless of whether patients had node positive or not. Of course, this was approved in September, so we now have two agents available in the adjuvant setting.
So one of the things that we got into in the discussion there in San Antonio was kind of the selection of patients to receive an adjuvant CDK to start with. And one of the things that I've been finding really interesting about adjuvant study, not just in breast, but even in lung and other tumors, is that, you know, in the past, coming out of the world overview that was done with tamoxifen, chemotherapy, and ovarian suppression, et cetera, you know, we came away with the idea that, you know, yes, you see the trials, they usually have higher risk patients and you get a hazard rate, but the hazard rate applies along all the risk of the patients. And you can calculate the absolute benefit if you apply the hazard rate to what you perceive to be the risk, come up with an absolute benefit, and decide, you know, whether or not it's worth it to the patient or help the patient figure out whether it's worth it. But then when I look at investigators, I see them following the trial design. So like here, you gave the patient ribo because she was node negative. And, you know, like I could say, well, why don't we just, you could even pick palbo. I know there's no data on it, but if you think of it's a class effect, they all have the same hazard rate. Why are we so, you know, sticking so tight to the data?
Yeah, it's a good point. Well, for palbo, we had two negative trials, so I'm not sure it's a class effect, at least in the early stage setting. And it's the one drug that doesn't have any survival benefit in the metastatic setting. So if you're, you know, being a purist and think, okay, this is probably, it's the best tolerated one, but, you know, it also doesn't have these endpoints met. So, but for the ribo, abemaciclib discussion and differences in them, I mean, I think you're totally right. I think from my perspective, why I would go to ribo here is because it's better tolerated, I think, from a patient standpoint, because there isn't that diarrhea side effect. Patients aren't really aware that they have neutropenia when they have neutropenia from ribo. And we have to monitor their liver enzymes and their EKGs with ribo, but these aren't things that they're really aware of. And these are women who are had chemo for the most part, are really tired, want to get on with their life. And so, you know, if she'd been node positive, my patient, I probably still would have offered ribociclib. I don't know, but your point is well taken. You don't have to be a purist in applying the eligibility criteria of a study if you think you have two drugs that work similarly effectively.
I guess another obvious issue here, as you pointed out, is a duration difference of 3 years versus two. How do you see that? I mean, I guess you could say people who get out to 2 years, if they're, you know, at that point, hopefully they're tolerating well. Maybe it's not that big a deal to do an extra year. Maybe there's some theoretical advantage in your mind. How do you see that issue of two versus three? And do you apply that? Do you use 2 years of them? Do you use 3 years of ribo in this patient? Is that your intention?
Yeah, I talk to all patients about it, and some patients, quite honestly, will choose abemaciclib because they want to be done in 2 years. Both studies did have dropout of patients who came off. Gosh, I can't remember the exact number at the last reporting of Natalie, but I think both were somewhere in the 20%. 25% range. So that's something to consider. Maybe it's easier to get somebody through the full 2 years if you use abemaciclib. I tend to, you know, I recommend the length of therapy as the studies were done, but there are some patients who just struggle with the fatigue and not feeling great on it and aren't able to complete it.
So we saw data from Natalie looking at the impact of dose reductions of ribo. I'm curious what your thoughts are about that, as well as dose reductions with abema, and how often you actually do dose reductions, and what are the usual reasons you do it for?
Yeah, it was interesting. There was Erica Hamilton presented these data at San Antonio and did this 4-year landmark looking at the IDFS based on the relative dose intensity, and showed that the IDFS was similar in all patients who receive ribo, regardless of the relative dose intensity. And so that's reassuring that if we have to reduce dose for patients who are on ribo, their outcome's not going to be affected. We can't, however, say that starting at a lower dose leads to the same benefit. If you think of dose reductions for toxicity, it's kind of like individualizing a patient's experience based on their pharmacodynamics, right? How does their liver process the drug, and how toxic is it? And patients who have more toxicity may just be slower metabolizers. So you're doing the dose reductions and maybe getting to a similar level as somebody who is a fast metabolizer staying on a high dose. So I don't use the data to say, let's start at a low dose, it'll be fine. For the abemaciclib, they also did a similar analysis. And similarly, the relative dose intensity didn't seem to impact the 4-year IDFS rates. And so that's reassuring data in terms of when we dose reduce. For abema, I'm dose reducing primarily for diarrhea. And for the ribociclib, it's the prolonged neutropenia, although I've had a few patients who have liver transaminase elevations that have required me holding the dose and then resuming. But the liver transaminase abnormalities don't appear to be dose responsive, so I haven't had luck doing it in that situation.
So I want to move on to the issue of metastatic disease, and just so much going on in terms of endocrine therapy. We actually had two posters at San Antonio on surveys we did of investigators and oncologists, and we have two more abstracts that we just submitted to ASCO, also on choice of endocrine therapy, metastatic disease. There's just so much now going on for people to try to keep straight in their mind. But let's begin with your thoughts in terms of first-line therapy, and particularly the much-discussed issue of choice of CDK inhibitor. I'm curious globally how you think through the data and how you choose the agent.
It's a terrific question. It's an embarrassment of riches. We have three available. And I'm not including the newer data with inavolisib because I think that's a separate topic and maybe not totally first line, but palbo, ribo, and abema. I think they all have very similar objective response rates and very similar progression-free survival benefits in terms of hazard ratio. Where the differences seem to come in is the side effect profile, the dosing frequency, with abema being continuous but twice daily, and the other two being 3 weeks on, 1 week off, and the differences in overall survival rates. So for toxicity, I think nobody would argue that they have differences in toxicity. I think palbo is probably the best tolerated. I can put somebody who's got a lot of comorbidities and is frail on palbo, and I'm not really worried about them as much. Whereas with abema, I have to be very careful with them with diarrhea and monitor them closely the first month so that they're not at home getting dehydrated. And with ribociclib, there's a more intense monitoring in the beginning with EKGs, et cetera. And you have to think about drug-drug interactions. So those are real world things you have to think about as you're talking with a patient about the selection. I think that probably more than anything comes into play when we're making a patient-based decision and shared decision-making. It is important to note only ribociclib has survival data consistently from three studies, MONA 2, 3, and 7, that there is a survival benefit of adding ribo to endocrine therapy. As yet, we haven't seen data with survival from palbo. Abema, though, the study shows a pretty impressive more than a year difference in favor of abema, but it just didn't meet that pre-specified statistical significance to call it.
Actually, one of the things we submitted to ASCO was looking at how people choose CDK. What we saw was, in general, ribo was generally the most commonly used, but we were able to put out a number of situations that you alluded to, particularly related to comorbidities, where people thought of other issues. Also, the question of whether you have, I don't know how often you see CNS disease, but if you do see CNS disease, what are the situations, first of all, in terms of abema? I've heard people talk about, more visceral disease, liver mets, any of those kind of things will trigger you to use abema versus ribo.
So I think with abema, it does have CNS penetration, and that's been clinically shown in a very elegant study that Sarah Tolaney led, just a few patients, like looking at the blood level, CSF level, and CNS tumor level of abemaciclib after perioperative dosing with abemaciclib in patients who underwent surgery. I think it was three patients, but boy, was that cool data. And we have seen a little bit of data of benefit there. So I would lean toward abema in somebody with brain metastases. I would also use abema later line in patients as a single agent. It's the only one with a single agent indication. And in patients who'd previously had palbo, because it's more potent and hits other targets, so, and has proven benefits post palbo from post monarch. Other than that, I'm not really buying the use this one for visceral mets versus bone only mets. I think that's like a subgroup analysis, interpretation, sort of retrospective. I don't believe in my heart of hearts that one is better than the other based on where the tumor location is outside of the CNS, but that might be a controversial statement.
You also mentioned the issue of palbo and people with comorbidities. Can any clinical situation, you can remember a patient maybe where you'd use palbo, or any kind of comorbidities that might make you think about that?
Certainly patients who have had GI issues, trouble with IBS or other inflammatory bowel disorders where they have chronic diarrheal or GI issues, I lean against abemaciclib. And for ribo, anybody who's on concomitant medications that are going to potentially impact their risk of QTc prolongation, history of liver enzyme elevations. And in America, we have a lot of patients who have NASH, steatohepatitis. And so I may lean against ribociclib there. But again, patients who tolerate drugs are more sensitive to their side effects. I do think palbo probably is better tolerated than the others in terms of side effect profile. I've had patients on it for many, many years.
So you also mentioned the use of, INAVO 120 study using a triplet regimen, including inavolisib, the PIK3 inhibitor, in the first-line metastatic setting. I'm curious, and we did a survey on that, and I was very curious about that. That seems to be completely being picked up, but I guess there is also the issue in whom, again, getting back to this idea of, do you use the criteria of the study, which I think they had to either be on adjuvant endocrine therapy within 12 months of it. I kind of wonder, what about 2 years or 3 years? How are you thinking through that first line situation and people who have PIK3 mutations?
Yeah, I mean, it's unusual to see patients in my own practice, I haven't had one recently where a patient comes in with progression on their adjuvant AI. Maybe I've been lucky, but then is found to also have a PIK3CA mutation and be eligible for this regimen. So it is not an everyday common occurrence. It's certainly not as common as seeing somebody who just has hormone receptor positive metastatic disease first line setting. So they're really looking for patients who are endocrine resistant based on those criteria and have the PIK3CA mutation. And then you have to think about how they qualified for going on the study in terms of their hyperglycemia risk. And so the HbA1c, I forget the exact level, I want to say it was like 6.5 was the HbA1c criteria for going on the study. So because of the risks of hyperglycemia and all of these side effects that can occur by hitting this pathway, you have to be very thoughtful about how to apply these data. The outcomes were impressive, and I think this certainly should be a regimen that is utilized. I think we have to acknowledge that the path toward getting a combination of PI3 kinase inhibition with a CDK4/6 inhibitor has been a bumpy one. Most of those studies that were done stopped in the phase 1b setting because of toxicity to the liver or GI system. So it's kind of a pretty cool thing that we have one that worked and was tolerable. Maybe it's because it was combined with palbociclib.
Yeah, and that was the other thing. We were talking about choice of CDK. There they use palbo. I assume that's what you do. It seems like that's what people are doing.
Yeah, I'm not brave enough to venture off and use other ones because of that toxicity risk.
I'm curious, how many times have you actually used the triplet?
I have recommended it, but I have not prescribed it myself. So with second opinions, I've recommended it, but I've not actually given the patient the treatment myself.
That's interesting. I would have thought it'd be a more common scenario, but it's very interesting what you're saying, that you don't see it that much. You mentioned the issue of tolerability, and this comes up with other agents, capivasertib, alpelisib, and particularly in terms of glucose control. And I remember at the meeting, you made an interesting comment. I'm not sure if I followed up on it, but I'm going to follow up now about, I think you said you put patients on a keto diet, or you would put patients on a keto diet or getting some of these agents. And just curious, and we talked about the GLP-1 agonist as well, in patients who have a higher hemoglobin A1C. Any thoughts in general about using these agents, including inavolisib, as it relates to glucose control?
Yeah, I think we are forced to become endocrinologists a bit as oncologists. We've gotten pretty good at being gastroenterologists, and now we're having to hone in on our endocrinology skills. And so, yes, with when Alpelisib came out, that's when my APP and I began instituting keto diets as a run-up to starting it. So we'd prescribe the Alpelisib, and in the week or two that we were waiting for the pharmacy delivery to happen, the patients would start a keto diet. And just really, you know, it's almost like a diabetic diet, right? We would have patients see a nutritionist and talk about low carb and how to increase your protein and et cetera, and be mindful of signs of hyperglycemia. So educating patients on the increased thirst, increased urination, and all of those things, because we did have a few patients early on who came to clinic and said, you know, I can't stop urinating and their sugars are in the 400s. So wanted to avoid that. And I think that education has helped pave the way for us incorporating drugs like inavolisib and capivasertib into our clinical practice.
Just a note also, I think interesting, in the INAVO 120 study, that actually a quarter of the patients had the dose interrupted because of glucose issues, but only 2% had dose reduction, and less than 1% had it discontinued. That sounds a lot better than what we saw with alpelisib. I'm not so sure about capi, whether that's in between, but what's in general been your experience, and particularly as it relates to glucose control with these three agents?
Yeah. So with capi, I haven't had much of a problem with this, maybe because we're doing this run up with keto. And as I said, I haven't seen patients on INAVO. I think alpelisib, we had patients get into trouble with sugar, even, you know, with their keto diet, et cetera. It takes a patient who's super, super engaged and communicative, who's going to call, because you can't call the patient every day, but you need to have an easy way for them to reach you and be willing to do that. So I have to say, in the clinical practice, I used a lot of patient selection myself in determining who to use or who to prescribe or recommend the use of one of these agents. And so that patient selection is kind of reflective of how patient selection happened in these studies, right? Because they were very selective on the limits of what the HbA1c could be, and you know, patients who had pre-existing insulin-dependent diabetes, for example, were not going to be eligible for one of these agents. So I think that's just something we've had to learn to incorporate in our practices.
Also, the question of, do you know, capi has this unusual schedule where you get it for a few days and you hold it for a few days. Do you see any difference when they're off it, or because of the half-life, it really just sort of evens out? Or do people feel different, or is their glucose under better control when they're off it?
Yeah, they do notice when they're off it. I do think they feel better. You know, the diarrhea and the fatigue and all of these things tend to get better in my own practice. That's what I've noticed with the capi.
So this lady is interesting because, if I understand this case correctly, she represents a subset that we found very interesting when we asked people what they do. I think I'm reading here she had both an ESR1 and PIK3. And we saw people all over the place about whether they use a capi or elacestrant. Can you talk about her and why you ended up using capi?
Yeah, she was 61. She was working full time and very vigorous, and developed back pain and bone pain that got worse and worse and worse, and finally was seen and had to be hospitalized because it was so debilitating, and was told she most likely, based on her imaging, had multiple myeloma. They did a whole myeloma workup and even did a bone marrow biopsy, and that's where they found ER positive HER2 1 plus metastatic breast cancer with no imaging evidence of a primary tumor in the breast. There was a slightly enlarged lymph node, and we went after it, and there was the invasive lobular carcinoma. Not surprising, it's so hard to see that on imaging. And so, you know, a very unfortunate situation. She's one of the ones I was talking about, telling you about earlier. She did receive radiation to her thoracic spine and developed severe esophagitis, couldn't swallow, like was hospitalized for that for a few days. And during that hospitalization had a PE due to a right lower lobe or a right lower extremity DVT. So really bumpy start. And we started her on letrozole and ribo. And within a few months, she was back to work. She was doing much, much better. Unfortunately, and we did do tumor testing of the bone biopsy. This all happened before the ANAVO data was presented, but she was found to have a PIK3CA E545K mutation and a PIK3CA mutation and ESR1 mutation on the blood that was sent at the time of progression. So her disease progressed 9 months after ribo, which is a pretty short time of benefit from a first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor. So we discussed elacestrant, the progression-free survival associated with it, the fact that she had less than 12 months or fewer than 12 months of benefit seemed to indicate she probably wouldn't do as well with elacestrant in terms of a long-term disease control. And she's a really a proactive patient who's very communicative with the office and was engaged with, closely being monitored and doing a keto diet. So we ultimately decided after a discussion about alpelisib and everolimus and Capi, she chose to start Capi and fulvestrant. And she did this 2 weeks ago now.
So how are the first couple of weeks going?
Well, the first week went really well, but this week I got paged because she developed a very severe rash on her lower extremities, and it was small little spots initially, and she was taking Zyrtec daily, and then it just became this very diffuse, very aggressive rash involving her entire lower extremities and beginning to go up her trunk a bit. So we had to place her on oral steroids. So she's actually being seen today to see how she's doing. And we skipped the last dose of her, on days. She's now in her off days, and we'll see how she does.
So, yeah, I was just about to ask you about rash and diarrhea with Capi. What's your experience been with those issues, and how does it respond to dose reduction? Or can you do dose reduction?
Yeah, you can do dose reduction for both. I think the antihistamine use for the rash is beneficial, and oral steroids when you have to. We'll be dose reducing her when we resume after she's, recovered. The diarrhea can be intermittent. It can occur several months in my experience. And so you just need, again, close patient contact and a lot of education about hydration, having anti-motility agents on hand at home, et cetera.
So I guess the other issue here, as you mentioned, she had a very short period of time on CDK. I'm curious how that variable, sometimes people are on for a couple years. So occasionally you see patients like this. Do you ever skip second-line endocrine therapy, at least initially, and go to capecitabine or some other therapy in a patient with a short time on CDK?
Yeah, that's a great question. I tend to, I think all of us are now using ctDNA to kind of guide our reaction to that short interval. And I would say the majority of patients have a mutation in the PI3 kinase pathway that explains the short disease responsiveness. So I'm usually using doublet therapy in that setting with a PI3 kinase pathway inhibitor before going to capecitabine. I guess if I saw somebody have, fewer than 6 months of response, if at the first cycle their disease was clearly progressing and there were lower expression levels of ER, maybe I'd be tempted to go to capecitabine or even consider an ADC. It's not a very frequent occurrence, though.
So I'm curious about your thoughts about oral SERDs. Of course, we have elacestrant now. We saw some pretty interesting data presented at San Antonio from the so-called EMBER-3 study of another SERD that's currently not approved, imlunestrant. We have another agent, camizestrant, that looks like it's got a lot of activity and all these agents being studied in earlier situations. Can you provide sort of an overview, first of all, of who are the types of patients you're giving oral SERD monotherapy to nowadays, and whether you see much difference between them in terms of efficacy and tolerability, whether the side effects, you know, sometimes I hear people talking about phytopsia and other, you know, unusual side effects. And now that, you know, we maybe are going to have another SERD approved, we'll see what happens with the monotherapy with imlunestrant. If it does get approved, how are you going to choose between that and elacestrant?
Yeah, easy questions.
All in 30 seconds.
It is an interesting time to see all of these therapies sort of come to fruition and to see late stage data relating to them. As of today, we have elacestrant available. And that is the only oral SERD that we have that's FDA approved, and it's not approved in combination. As you said, it's only in as a single agent. And so I do think most of us are selecting our patients carefully and selecting those patients who have an ESR1 mutation, which is the FDA-approved indication for elacestrant. We're not using it in wild type, so this means the vast majority of our patients have received already an aromatase inhibitor and have developed resistance to that. And we do see that, you know, those patients who had a longer benefit with a CDK4/6 inhibitor tend to have a better outcome from their next line of therapy being elacestrant if they have an ESR1 mutation. So for a patient who had 6 months of benefit from a CDK4/6 inhibitor, the elacestrant PFS was only about 4 months, but if they benefited from a CDK4/6 inhibitor for over a year or a year and a half, and they have an ESR1 mutation, you can expect the PFS to be around 8.5 months. So I think we're using those sort of clinical features to help guide patient selection. Imlunestrant is an interesting agent that, as you said, was presented in the EMBER study. It was tested in either alone against single agent and standard of care endocrine therapy, which was either fulvestrant or exemestane. And then there was this third arm where imlunestrant was combined with abemaciclib. And similar to all the data we're seeing with other oral SERDs, imlunestrant's benefit seems to be restricted to patients whose tumors have an ESR1 mutation. And there you're seeing, you know, about a month and a half benefit in terms of, against standard of care endocrine therapy with imlunestrant. So the median PFS is somewhere around 5.5 months. But if you look at imlunestrant combined with abemaciclib, you're seeing now about a 9.5 month progression-free survival in all patients. So I think many of us are wondering whether or not we're going to see imlunestrant approved in combination with abemaciclib or only as a single agent for ESR1 mutated cancer. I'm not convinced that we should be using imlunestrant abema for all patients who are not ESR1 mutated, because I'm not convinced yet that that is a better combination than plain old fulvestrant abema or AI abema in patients with wild type ESR. That wasn't one of the control arms, so that's an unanswered question. A number of other oral SERDs are in development that we may see. There is also vepdegestrant, which is a PROTAC against ER. There's some interesting degraders like that that are being evaluated, all in phase 3 studies. So a year from now, Neil, we'll have probably more agents to talk about that may be approved.
Incidentally, I was going to ask you before, one of the things we saw in our survey related to AKT, P10, et cetera, was not too much use of alpelisib anymore. It seemed like everybody was using CAPI, I guess, for toxicity purposes. Is that kind of the way your practice has been looking?
Yeah, alpelisib was just, it's just tough. It's tough to tolerate. And so now that we have Capi available, and everolimus for those without PIK3CA mutations, I think that's pretty much what clinicians are using because it's better tolerated.
So, in the discussion after AMBER-3, Hal Burstein was talking about a lot of things related to oral SERDs in addition to AMBER-3, including tolerability. And I am curious, you know, we have, you know, trials now looking at in the adjuvant setting, you know, from the beginning and the middle, you know, looking at the ESR1 only positive patients. I don't know how much experience you have, you know, with all, you know, for example, with camizestrin, which is currently not available, or imlunestrin, but anything from your point of view that fundamentally is different in terms of tolerability or efficacy?
The efficacy, I think more and more we're seeing consistent data that it seems, if you're looking at a superiority, the efficacy seems to be superior with these drugs compared to AIs in the presence of an ESR1 mutation. But it looks pretty similar. To AIs in wild type ESR. So I think it's not inappropriate to look at using them in the adjuvant setting and maybe even in a sort of switching strategy where you start with an AI and then switch to the oral SERD after several years to mitigate any ESR1 mutations that have sort of been, have developed through selective pressure. Tolerability is different. I think all of the oral SERDs seem to have GI side effects, namely nausea associated with them. And, you know, maybe less of the arthralgia that we see with aromatase inhibitors, but fatigue and nausea and even some vomiting. You mentioned the photopsia with camizestrin, which I think is pretty self-limited. It's not a major issue. It's just something you have to warn patients about and then adapt to. But it'll be interesting. I'm not sure how the adjuvant data are going to sort themselves out. I was involved in the Ladera study, which was giredestrin, looking at that. And we'll have to see. I don't know how they compare to one another. If you're just looking at the PFS data that have emerged or the neoadjuvant data where we look at Ki-67 changes, I can't say that we're seeing a front runner. Amcenestrin seems to have dropped out, but we're not seeing a front runner in terms of, wow, this one's going to be the TDXD of oral SERDs.
Have you ever had a patient have photopsia? I'm curious what they actually tell you.
I have not, actually, no. It sounds kind of interesting. I've heard several of my colleagues talk about it, but not actually had a patient experience it.
Yeah, I think it's like something you walk into a dark room and you see lights. So what happened with this lady who got the elacestrin? I see that she had an ESR1 Y5377S mutation. She had previously got anastrozole. She presented de novo for 8 years, pretty interesting, and then got ribo and fulvestrin for 2.5 years, and now has been on elacestrin. How's she doing on the treatment?
She's doing great. She's had nausea that she deals with, so we're treating that. And her diet modifications have helped a little bit. She's not eating as much of the dairy-related or rich products, and that seems to have helped with the nausea. But she's feeling very well. And I, you know, thought that elacestrant made a lot of sense here. She didn't have a PIK3CA mutation. I wasn't convinced that doing something like fulvestrant with everolimus would actually improve her tolerability or her long-term outcome. And given how well she did on ribociclib with that nice 30-month progression-free survival, we selected to go with elacestrant, hoping that she'll get 8 to 12 months out of that before progression and maybe even better. But yeah, she's one of those patients who just was mystifying. She was on anastrozole for so long, doing so well, and then her disease progressed.
Getting back to this issue, your previous patient, patients who have PIK3 and ESR1, which I guess is not rare, What's a typical situation where you'll choose Capi versus a typical situation where you'll go with an oral SERD like elacestrant?
I think usually it's going to be based on the PIK3CA mutation. If I can combine it with fulvestrant, I feel like I'm getting a little bit of gas out of the engine there against the ESR1 mutation. Not all of the ESR1 mutations are sensitive to fulvestrant, but I tend to go after the PIK3CA mutation or PI3 kinase pathway mutation first. And again, just because we don't yet have an oral SERD in combination with the targeted therapy, if we had imlunestrant with abemaciclib, or imlunestrant, sorry, with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, or elacestrant with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, then I'd go for that. That's an easy one. But right now, we're forced to choose between those two strategies.
So I just want to finish out with the AMBER-3 study, which in San Antonio, I thought to myself, I do not understand this. Then I spent a couple hours with Kamal Javari in early January. I sort of understand it a lot better, but I still find the whole thing personally. Maybe it's just me, but I'm just trying to figure it out. You know, can you just sort of go back over sort of your view of it in terms of what they looked at, and particularly in terms, as you were saying, this issue of the arm that had imlunestrant and abemaciclib. Most of these patients had prior CDK, but a fair number did not, and it didn't look like there's any difference. It didn't seem like there's any difference based on ESR1. So I came away thinking, well, I definitely can see thinking about it in second line, but what about first line? What about ESR wild type? I don't even know where to begin, but any thoughts?
Yes, AMBER-3 is a very interesting study. The nice thing about it is it was like a study that incorporated combining the oral SERD with the CDK4/6 inhibitor. So it was a combination strategy kind of early on, which everybody's been asking for, because all of the oral SERDs were first being tested as single agents. And, you know, in practice, we tend to use combination strategies. So it had three arms, imlunestrant given daily, standard of care exemestane or fulvestrant, or imlunestrant plus abemaciclib. And it was a 1-to-1-to-1 randomization. And the patients had to have a recurrence on or within 12 months of completion of an AI and CDK4/6 inhibitor. So 100% of patients had to have had a prior AI, and then with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And they allowed patients who had come off of adjuvant therapy, so their recurrence happened within 12 months of being on adjuvant therapy. They also allowed patients who progressed on frontline therapy in the frontline setting, but they could only have had like been one of those. So they couldn't have any other therapy for advanced disease, for example. So are you confused yet? Because that was a little bit confusing. Just the entry criteria. But they then wanted to look first at the single agent imlunestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy as the progression-free survival in those patients with an ESR1 mutation. Then they wanted to look at, imlunestrant versus standard of care in all patients. And then they wanted to compare the doublet of imlunestrant abema versus imlunestrant itself. So that was a study design. And what they were lacking, the criticism of this trial, is that there wasn't a fulvestrant abemaciclib arm, if you will, or endocrine therapy standard with abema to really interrogate what's imlunestrant adding, especially in those with ESR1 wild type. So for the first question, imlunestrant beat standard of care endocrine therapy in patients with a tumor ESR1 mutation. The PFS was 5.5 months with imlunestrant versus 3.8 months with standard of care endocrine therapy. It was about a 38% relative risk benefit in that analysis. But when you look at patients who All patients, there was no difference. It was the same for imlunestrant versus standard of care if you included patients with or without an ESR1 mutation. So it wasn't superior, but it looked as good to use either of them in patients if you didn't select based on the ESR1 mutation. And then to get to the question, that third question, how does imlunestrant and abema compare to imlunestrant alone? The imlunestrant abema PFS was 9.4 months versus 5.5 months imlunestrant alone. And this is not selected based on ESR1 mutations. So it does appear that adding abemaciclib to imlunestrant statistically significantly improves the progression-free survival. The hazard ratio is 0.57. So it met that endpoint. But then that just made everyone kind of ask, well, what about patients if you just gave the patients who are ESR1 wild type fulvestrant with abemaciclib? So do you really need the new expensive drug in order to get that benefit? Does that make sense?
No, I think it makes sense. I guess you could say in patients who prefer oral, which I guess would be everybody, I guess, you could, you know, that might sort of push you away from fulvestrant. But I was, you know, it was interesting. Our way of doing stuff is actually, it was funny because the EMBER-3 data came out and we still hadn't done two of our meetings. So I had like 10 investigators. I asked everybody before the meeting, I said, would you like to have imlunestrant monotherapy available? Everybody said, yes, we need another option. But then the thing that really surprised me is I said, would you like to be able to give imlunestrant and abema? And everybody said yes, which I wasn't sure after seeing the data. But I think this case that you pulled out is a great example. I guess you could say it's sort of a combination of a SERD case as well as a monarch, post-monarch case together, sort of, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's an interesting time.
This is a real patient in your practice?
Yes, this is somebody who was treated with first-line palbo-letrozole. She did really well and then had disease progression, and she's got this D538G mutation on ctDNA, an ESR1 mutation, but nothing else. And this is somebody where we'll be discussing the use of elacestrant. But if I had imlunestrant available, I might consider using that in combination with abemaciclib, given that this would sort of meet that criteria of the EMBER-3 clinical trial. She had disease progress on palbo, and patients were allowed on the trial who had received prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. We have the post-monarch data indicating that patients whose disease progressed on palbo do get extra mileage by switching to abemaciclib. So I think we have a couple of trials that speak to this. And, this is the one situation where I might use it. If she had no ESR1 mutation and I had imlunestrant available, I'd probably offer her imlunestrant single agent. I'm not totally convinced that that we should be giving it with abemaciclib. Interested in offering her abemaciclib, but not convinced right. that I would have to give it with imlunestrant. Right. I would be thinking along the lines of fulvestrant here.
Yeah, like a post-monarch patient who got exactly. palbo for seven years too. That got the palbo. Yeah, just finishing out. You know, getting back to Hal Burstein's discussion, I remember he used to show a slide indirectly comparing the CDK inhibitors, and he always put it up and say, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but let's take a look at it. And this time he was comparing all the oral SERDs, and then at the end he had the abema imlunestrant, which, as you say, was not over 9 months, which had not been seen before. And so I guess at least that's a hint that we're moving in the right direction, I guess.
Yeah, it's very promising. These are positive data in an era where we need positive data and good news.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Hurvitz, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Lowe for Oncology Today.